Hi, I'm Sophie, and this is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter, a space devoted to all things health, wellness, and longevity. Because for me, aging well is about looking and feeling like the best possible version of ourselves, inside as well as out. So together with my producer, Fee, I'll be deep diving into the latest research, sifting fact from fiction. I'll also be talking to all kinds of trusted experts, tapping into their knowledge, along with bringing you conversations from a range of interesting women and men, finding out how they age well. So, this is my show. Welcome along. And as always, thank you so much for listening. Stacey, your biography is one of the most compelling and impressive we've had on this show. Among many things, you have a PhD in exercise physiology, you're a pioneering researcher, and by the way, I'm seriously impressed at how many peer-reviewed papers you've had published. You're a former professional athlete, you're one of the world's most in-demand trainers, you're a best-selling author, and you're widely considered to be the leading voice on why women need to approach exercise differently to men. You've also been on some of the biggest podcasts in the world, from Mel Robbins to Stephen Bartlett to Andrew Huberman. So firstly, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome you onto my show. We love the name of your now infamous TED Talk, Women Are Not Small Men. And I do want to dig into some of the themes here around the appalling lack of research done specifically on women in regards to exercise and nutrition. But shall we start with the question that I know you probably get asked all the time, but if you wouldn't mind covering it for all of my audience, why should women exercise differently to men? And within your answer, if you don't mind, what are some of the common mistakes that women make? And I appreciate this might be quite a long answer.
Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me on your show. I'm very excited to be chatting. And when we start really getting into the nuts and bolts of why women should be approaching so many things differently than men, if we disseminate down to the exercise portion of all biomedical research, it really hems on the fact that it's a genetic coding. If we're thinking about, I have to apologize here because the research really is binary. It's XX versus XY. So when we're looking at that research that's available, we see that so many things start in utero from the fact that there's XX versus XY. And the coding from that can dictate the muscle morphology. So this means that women being XX are born with more slow twitch or those oxidative endurant type fibers and less of the fast twitch glycolytic fibers. We see that there's a difference in stress resilience. We see there's differences in the way that women versus men approach even social situations. We can definitively see that happening at the onset of puberty, where we have the expression of our estrogen, progesterone in girls and a rise in testosterone in boys, right down to how we coach our kids, where boys are very adept to being the center of attention and they have that aggression and that confidence that comes, especially in sport. But girls feel like everyone is watching them and they don't want to be watched. So they do much better in a group situation. And this isn't driven by most of the social constructs. It's actually driven by the way the brain is developing with the exposure of these hormones. So if we fast forward into how this affects women of reproductive age and onwards, we have to really question the protocols that have been brought forth, the way that people are approaching exercise intensity, duration, what is the motivation behind it, why are we trying to look for certain outputs or endpoints. And if we bring that back to the research, we see that most of the research of the basic protocols has been generalized to women from data on men. So if we start to really understand women's physiology and know that women are more endurant, so they might need less time between repetitions and sets in strength training to gain the same kind of training stress that men have. Or we're looking at the upsurge of ultra-endurance athletes being more successful because they are female, and that has to do with the more endurant type fibers. So when we really start to have that examination in the literature and the fact that we have XX versus XY, plus then the epigenetic exposure of our sex hormones, there's a whole myriad of changes that we have to be aware of, right down to how women fuel or how their bodies fuel for different types of exercise, how our hypothalamus as a woman responds to things like fasting or appetite hormones versus men. So when we are really trying to optimize human performance for women. And when I say human performance, I don't mean the Olympics. I mean you as a human maximizing your own performance. As a woman, we have to look at your physiology and say, hold up. A lot of the stuff that's being promoted out there is based on male data and being promoted by male influencers or male doctors who are still looking through a male lens.
Thank you so much, Stacey. And it makes complete sense. We are physiologically so different from men. Why do we think we should be nourishing our bodies? And I mean that through exercise and diet in the same way. As we've both alluded to, people are finally starting to talk about the misogyny in the women's healthcare and exercise space. And you speak brilliantly about all of this, from science and research, even down to how products and kit are developed. So, for example, things like running shoes or bicycles. Can you talk to us more about this and the shrink and pink theory?
Yeah, so I've come from, you know, the sport background, and I've been in the industry creating products and trialing products. And there's been a huge buzz of women's specificity. So when we start really looking at what does that mean to be women specific, basically big companies have just made their products smaller and put some pink on it and called it a woman's product. So that's why what we mean by shrink and pink. And we see it everywhere. We see it from protein bars on the market, the Ladies Bar or the Athenas or whatever protein bar might be on the market. It's a smaller version of the men's, less calories, probably has some soy in it instead of full whey, and it has some pink on the packaging. We see it in running shoes. We see it in bike fit. We see it in a lot of the other equipment that's out there. Even when we're looking at gym equipment, the gym equipment, the machines have been designed for a 6'2" guy who's around 180 pounds. And then you're supposed to make it smaller by adjusting it for women, but it's not right. Our proportions are different. Our hands are smaller. We can't have the same grip. We have different Q angle, which is the angle from the hip to the knee. So things like the leg press is not optimal for our bodies. And people are like, no, it's fine for you. You just make it smaller. So when we start looking at what is shrink and pink, it's really just a disservice to women through the lens of marketing, trying to improve the amount of products that are out there, but they are not very good products. And we see that all the way down to wearables and algorithms that are in wearables. When we're looking at our recovery metrics or heart rate variability or some of the sleep metrics that are given through our Apple Watches or other devices. And the algorithms are based on male physiology, and there's a misstep in the output for women because we have a different way that our heartbeat responds for the fact that we have a smaller QRS interval, and it's read as a misstep from the algorithms, not a normalcy. We see that when after ovulation, we have an upsurge or an uprising of progesterone, we have a change in our respiratory rate and our resting heart rate. Respiratory rate goes up, resting heart rate goes up, and so our metrics for recovery looks like we're tanking. So again, you know, people are talking about menstrual cycle tracking on wearables and stuff for women, but it's just mouth to words from marketing. It's not the real science behind it.
Stacey, and like Sophie said, this is all so fascinating. And I think it's also interesting that your work is centered around strength training, because most of us that came of age in the 80s and 90s, including me, were taught that the best exercise for women was aerobic exercise. But can you give us the lowdown on why women, especially women, let's say mid-40s and beyond, should lift weights and the benefits beyond what we can see in the mirror?
Yeah, I'm definitely in that same age bracket of 80s to 90s where you're thinking about the fat burning classes and the 90-minute step aerobics and that whole thing. And we still see that as a prevalency in so many women who are in our age group and older, where they're like, cardio, I have to burn calories, and it's not right for our bodies. When we talk about strength training, there are so many pivotal points. And I say this as someone who comes from an extreme endurance background, from racing bikes professionally, Ironman, ultra running, all of that stuff. But as we really start looking at strength training and why it is so important to be muscle centric, and I will borrow a phrase from Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, where we have to start talking about how we gain things, not lose things. And we're talking about muscle. So if we think about strength training, as we start to get perimenopausal, which is, you know, our in our 40s, estrogen is very tightly tied to how muscle actually works. So if we think about our muscle contractile proteins, or how we actually have a strong contraction, we have two little proteins. One is myosin and one is actin, and they grab onto each other and pull together to create a contraction. Well, estrogen is responsible for how myosin responds. And when we start to have a perturbation in our estrogen, or estradiol specifically, our estradiol levels, we start to have a dysfunction in that myosin. So it doesn't grab onto actin very well. So we start to get weaker. We see the very first thing that goes when we hit perimenopause is strength and power. It's not lean mass. We also have a decrease in the anti-inflammatory effects of estrogen, which further dysregulates muscle contraction from a force generation perspective. We'll see this loss in strength and power about a year and a half before we actually see a discernible loss of lean mass, or before we see body composition change. So strength training is really super important because of the adaptations that happen by lifting weights. You offshoot that. You offset that dysfunction of myosin. So myosin can function well to maintain strength and power. The caveat is what kind of strength training you're doing. Ideally, we want women to learn how to lift in the heavier load range, because that's our power-based range, which really causes that conversation to occur from adaptation to make myosin work the way it should. We also see that lifting heavier loads feeds forward to better bone density. So that's the ideal. We want women who are older, perimenopausal onwards, to be able to lift heavier loads. But I don't want people to go out and start lifting heavy loads right away. We have to phase in. We like to say that it's a learned journey, and it is a privilege to be able to lift heavy. So you do have to phase your way in. So when we look at strength training from higher reps and lower weights, we do see benefit. We see benefit for some central nervous system gains, but it's not a complete reversal of that myosin dysfunction. We see there is some effect on bone, but not as great as if we were to do some jump training and higher intensity strength training work. So strength training becomes really pivotal as we start to get middle age and above. It's really essential for women who are younger to think about strength training as well, because the more you can put in the bank for building and maintaining lean muscle and bone, the better it is as we age. So it's never too early to start strength training, but becomes one of the bedrocks for aging well, especially when you hit perimenopause.
I think that's so helpful, because for so long, people talked about especially heavyweights as bulking women. And I think that rhetoric was really negative and harmful. So can you bring to life for us a little bit how many reps, what sort of weights we should be aiming for in an ideal world? And of course, every woman is different. And would it maybe be interesting to touch on what your research is showing in terms of why women get better results if they reduce the recovery time in between reps?
Yeah, so if we're looking at someone who is first starting strength training, and they've been the cardio queen forever, and they're like, I really want to dive in. I want better brain health as I get older, and I also want to preserve and build my lean mass. If we just first start strength training, then we want to be able to move well. So this means that you're going to have lighter loads. Maybe you're starting with resistance bands to gain the confidence of doing a pull-up or a lunge. And then you graduate to maybe 15 reps of a weight that feels relatively heavy, but it's still, you can complete 15 reps with really good form, with the eye to being able to move into what we call the power-based load. And a typical power-based type set would be 5 reps, 5 exercises. And you're working at 80% or more. So what do I mean by 80%? Because that's more of a technical way of talking about heavy weights. It's if you were to go pick up a weight and you could do 5 perfect repetitions with perfect form, and you might be able to eke out 2 more. That's heavy enough. So we don't want to be able to keep doing more and just stopping because we reached 5. We want to be able to hit the 5 and be struggling to be able to complete a 6 and a 7. So that's the type of loading that we're talking about. And we also want to look at how we periodize that. So we build up some strength and we deload or take some time off so our body can regenerate. Then we build a little bit more. So that's when we're looking at our chronic patterns of building our strength up. If we're looking at one session, we see that the typical rest is about 3 minutes when you're lifting heavy. And this is to regenerate central nervous system and our fuel system, our ATP-CP system. But by the nature that women have more endurant fibers and are not as heavily reliant on that fast ATP system, we're looking at really only needing around 2 to 2 minutes and 10 seconds for that recovery before you hit another one. And when we start looking at the protocols with that reduced amount of rest time, women can actually lift more load and get better adaptations rather than the consistent S&C of we need at least 3 minutes between every set.
We are going to ask you about diet and lifestyle too, because you have some fascinating things to say about, for example, women and breakfast and women and cold plunging and sauna. But first, we've talked a lot about strength training and we know how important this is for our body shape and our bones and even our brains. But for fat burning and heart health and better metabolic health, you talk about what you call sprint interval training. Can you explain what this is and bring it to life with some examples? And also, what can you teach us about the myokines released during exercise?
Sure. So when we're looking at what is optimal for health and health outcomes, when we are looking at high intensity work, we see that we have a better age response to our muscles. So we have a little bit of what's called cell senescence. So this is cells that stay alive, but they stop their replication. And this is how people age. If we're doing high intensity work, it creates a feedback where we can clear out those cells and regenerate and have cells that are responding as if there was fasting going on. So we get better telomere length, we get better cellular replication and better health. It increases the resilience of the DNA and the telomeres to any other kind of damage-inducing stress, so our environmental stress. So when we're really looking at the optimization of health span, we want to look at that high-intensity work. When we talk about high intensity, specifically sprint interval training, that means it's 30 seconds or less, as hard as you possibly can go, and you're recovering for 2 to 3 minutes, and then you do it again. We're not talking about Tabata. We're not talking about fartlek training and running. We're talking about being very specific to that high intensity of 30 seconds or less, and then that full recovery to be able to replicate that interval. Does not mean you have to run. It can be any mode. I really think that women should start by using an assault bike or a kettlebell just to feel what that intensity is in a mode of activity that feels relatively familiar and safe. And then we can start looking at other modes to hit that high intensity. If you don't have the availability of an assault bike or a kettlebell and you're out walking, maybe you pick up your pace or you find a hill incline or you find some stairs and you give it all you can for 30 seconds or less. And as we get fitter, we're able to change the mode, but that intensity is still going to be there. And you might finish with one or two and say, you know, I definitely can do one more. That's great. Do one more. But you don't really want to do any more than five. It's a very short, sharp, hard stress that you're putting on the body. And then we have adaptations. And these adaptations are multifold. We see better vascular compliance. So that means that our blood vessels are more responsive to contraction and dilation for better blood pressure control. We see myokines, which are little feedback and signals that are released from the skeletal muscle that circulate and tell the liver, hey, you know what? We don't want to take free fatty acids and make them into a form called esterified that gets stored as visceral fat. We need to keep these free fatty acids as free fatty acids to be able to be pulled into skeletal muscle to be used as a resting fuel. So we start to have better metabolism. We have better insulin sensitivity. And it is because this is such a strong stress on the body, the body's like, I need to adapt to that stress. and be ready for it again. So every time we have a little bit of a dose of that high intensity, it's feeding forward to preventing senescence of cell accumulation, increasing the resilience of the DNA, improving telomere length, improving our vascular compliance, and it is improving what we call BDNF, or our brain neurotrophic factor, which is like miracle grow to the brain, as well as improving neuroplasticity because we have fast muscle contraction. So for overall optimization of health, the research is so compelling to have women do this high-intensity work to improve all aspects of health through all systems of the body. The subset of high-intensity is what we call high-intensity interval training. And this is a little bit less intense, where the intervals are between 1 and 4 minutes at about 80%. And the recovery is variable between 1 and 4 minutes. And this is more of a metabolic control. So this is how we are able to have a greater push for body composition change. We see better glucose uptake by the cells. We see better resting blood glucose levels, better blood pressure. So all of our metabolic aspects happen at a little bit lower intensity. But when we're looking at really true epigenetic change, then we need that super high intensity of sprint interval work.
Thank you, Stacey. That's so helpful, and certainly something that I'll be reflecting on with regards to my training as well. Can you also explain the morphology of different women and why some women seem predisposed to get better gains from their exercise? So including things like body shape, and for example, why some women struggle to lose fat from their thighs?
Yes, so we see that there are different somatotypes, and the typical ones are our endomorph, our ectomorph, and our mesomorph. So an endomorph, or a true endomorph, is someone who puts on body fat relatively easily and has a really difficult time losing it. An ectomorph is someone who is Kate Moss-like, so, you know, pulling from the 90s supermodel, very, very skinny and has a really difficult time putting on lean mass. We see a lot of women who are ectomorphic are sarcopenic because they can't maintain really good lean mass quality. And then the third is mesomorphic. And so this is someone who could, like, look at a kettlebell and put on muscle mass really easily. Most people are a combination of them. So if you are someone who's like, yeah, I can put muscle on and I have a difficult time losing extra body fat, then we see that you're endomeso. So we have to be specific at the kind of high intensity work we put in, and definitely fueling in and around your training so that you're giving your body the fuel that it needs, so that the hypothalamus and the appetite hormones come in and are like, okay, we have some fuel, we can do this intensity, we don't have to conserve. If we're looking at someone who is an ectomorph primarily, so someone who has a really difficult time putting on lean mass, then we have to focus on that and minimizing the cardio, where we might have a sprint finisher. So we have a couple of 10-minute high-intensity sessions a couple of times a week after they're doing their strength training to get the cardiovascular and brain benefits of that high-intensity work, but not so much of a cardiovascular metabolic burn that people look for cardio. So when we're looking at the way that we are approaching our body type and the way that we're looking at the exercise modalities, we have to understand that when we are looking at where body fat is stored, people who have more of a pear shape or tend to store more fat in around the hips and thighs have a better time mobilizing it when they are looking at really peppering in some of that super high intensity work with polarized really low intensity. For someone who has more of the apple shape, so more of that visceral fat, strength training is really important because we see from the research that in women, strength training helps mobilize abdominal adiposity or belly fat. And again, when you put in some high-intensity interval training with that for more of a metabolic control and metabolic tap into cardiovascular work, you really do start to mobilize that visceral fat. So there isn't a catch-all for everyone who's out there to say, I have to do this every week. We have to take the person into play. We have to look at their body type, plus their experience within exercise? Are they someone who wants to be by themselves or support from society with regards to your society, your group, your community? Because we see when you have community and you have support, you tend to keep going and have more attrition and more, I guess, feelings of showing up for your friends. And it's really a positive environment. So we have to take all of those sociocultural as well as the body shapes into account when we're looking at prescribing an exercise program.
And you say that strong women stress less. Can you expand upon this correlation between women exercising more and being less hot-headed or less able to deal with their stress?
Yes. So when we are looking at women who are doing a lot of strength training, it's tapping into more of the neuroplasticity. So this means that brain health and brain acumen is very much there. And that feeds forward to better neurotransmitters and the ratios of our neurotransmitters. And also as women start to develop strength, they tend to have better posture. And it sounds not science-based, but it absolutely is, that if you have better posture and your shoulders are back and you're standing tall, you have better lung support and more openness to be able to breathe properly. And this brings in confidence. And it's just a physiological response to being able to use more of your lung capacity. So if we have more of that strength and empowerment, then we have the ability to be more stress resilient to all of the things that come our way. When we're looking at someone who's doing a lot of cardio work because we have this hangover from the 80s and 90s, we tend to see women who are in more of an overtrained or an overreached state. Because often what's coupled with that idea of doing lots of cardio is not eating as much as you need to because of the whole calories in, calories out idea. And we see that there's an increase in our baseline level of cortisol, and we see that there's more tissue inflammation systemically, and we have a reduction of stress resilience because the body is already at a tipping point of high stress. So we have to look at the recovery parts of people who are very much into cardio. And most women aren't willing to put in the recovery because of this holdover mindset that we've all kind of grown up with of we have to do lots of cardio and volume and it's all about the calorie burn. We know realistically now from the research, strength training, putting on lean mass, and eating enough to be able to maintain our overall health, our endocrine system, our immune system, as well as our lean mass, makes us so much stronger both now in the present, but also in 10, 20, 30 years down the track.
Thank you so much. And unlike Sophie, I'm very new to strength training and really all of this. So I wondered, what are the top 5 strength training exercises that you would recommend for women? I know that's a generalized question, but for example, are we talking about squats with like dumbbells or Russian twists or planks or like what would be your top 5 generally?
I always look at compound movements. And I mean, if you're new to strength training and you're just looking at what is a compound movement, a deadlift, a bench press, a squat, single leg Romanian deadlift, all of those things are, you know, a little bit foreign to people who are new to strength training. But it's all about using your core as well as proprioception for larger muscle use. So if we think about a deadlift, and you might just be using 2 dumbbells, and that's absolutely fine. You have to work on the hinge pattern. You have to be able to pull your shoulders back and down, activate the lats, activate your core, as well as work your glutes and your hamstrings to pull up and lower down. So if we're thinking about the biggest bang for your buck, we want to do compound movements. We want to look at how we move in the day from sit to stand as a squat, to bend over and pick something up off the ground. That's a hinge pattern. If we're going to put something up overhead on a shelf, that's a push press or a shoulder press. So all of these functional movements that we use during our daily life, we want to be able to mimic that movement in the gym with load. So if I were to say the top 5, I definitely would go squat and squat focus. So that could be anywhere from a goblet squat, dumbbells, barbell, any of those things that you're comfortable with. And if you're just starting, maybe your air squats with a resistance band. We see Bulgarian split squats. So that's one foot up on a bench and the other one in front of you using two dumbbells and using a bit of a hinge pattern to really get into the glute and protect the knee. We see our deadlift and our hinge pattern of a deadlift. So that can, again, be with a barbell or dumbbells or even a kettlebell. And we can go single leg deadlift, or maybe we're doing just a typical RDL or a typical deadlift or even a hex bar. All of that is a compound movement. So those are two and the variations within that. And then we can think about upper body. I like the idea of doing a push press because this is being able to use core and hip extension to push something up overhead. So if you're having to put something up on a top shelf or grab something off a top shelf, you have the full body capacity to be able to do that. And then we also look at how are we being able to open up our posture from being rounded at sitting at a computer all day. This is where we want to look at our bent over rows or our seated rows where we're having our rhomboid contraction. So again, it's about that functional movement. And then when we think about our core, we've used our core in all those compound movements. So then we can think about peppering a little bit of our Copenhagen planks, our Russian planks, our typical prone planks. And then we can look at using Russian twists or med ball slams against the wall to activate some of that twist and strengthen the twist motion.
Thank you.
You have a long list now. You're like, okay, I got to get back to this list.
Trust me, helpful. I'm writing them down.
although I'm thinking some of those plank variations I need to look up.
I was going to say, I've just started getting back into doing the Russian plank. And so that's your shoulders are on one bench and your heels are on another. So you're pretty much doing a supine plank that really does get into your glutes and your hamstrings.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's a toughie, but it's good, especially if you're trying to recover from injury.
Yeah, which so many people are, even if it's not injuries induced by exercise. If somebody listening has never done strength training, how do we start out to avoid injury? And also, how do they protect their pelvic floor or adapt a routine if they have a weak pelvic floor or even a prolapse?
So I always recommend someone who's going to start their strength training journey to find someone who can watch how they move. Because if we are not really aware that our movement patterns are not ideal and we start adding load, it predisposes you to injury right away. So learning how to move properly is really important. It could be working with a physio for one session just to see where some of the muscle tightness is. There are some experts online that you can have a Zoom call that can look at your form, or you can supply video and they can assess it and talk you through some things. But it's really important to understand your form and where you might have sticky points that you have to modify an activity. So that's the very first point. The second is don't try to start lifting too much too soon. I was working with a woman who's been out of strength training for about 15 to 20 years. And she was like, I want to jump right back in. I was like, wait, I want to see how you move. And so this is where we're using resistance bands to give her confidence to do some lunging. So she's lunging with a resistance band to give her a little bit of extra load, but also the ability to have a little bit more proprioception availability so she wouldn't overload her knee. So there are small steps that we take. Like I said, it's a journey into strength training, and it is relatively new because it's just now coming to mainstream. So we have to be very cognizant that not everyone is comfortable in these types of movements. So if we can work with them so that they understand how to squat properly, how to protect the knee, how to do a hinge pattern, then they can go off and running. When we start looking at individuals who have pelvic floor issues, this is something that so many women have and don't talk about. There are a couple of good experts that they can tap into online. So my friend Kim Valponi has the Buff Muff, and it's a really good app to show you how to be able to isolate and activate or relax pelvic floor. But if you have the accessibility of working with a pelvic floor specialist, then do that first, because everyone is individual. So if you don't know that you're hypertonic, then you go see a pelvic floor specialist. They're going to teach you how to be able to relax and then be able to isolate the pelvic floor muscles and get them to contract in the right pattern, because a lot of women have lost that capacity. We also see that as women get into perimenopause and we're losing the strength and power, it's not just our skeletal muscle that we think of, but it is also our pelvic floor. So we have to learn how to strengthen it. If we're looking with someone who has a prolapse, then we do see there are modifications that we can make. We see that there's a couple of really good apps that you can use that are working with devices to be able to see where pressure points are so that you know how deep you can go in a squat or what you need to do in a deadlift or what that range is before you start really irritating or perpetuating a greater stress for a prolapse. So I'm not an expert in pelvic floor, but I have worked with individuals who do have issues, and there are definitely lots of options out there to get help to be able to progress. Because again, there are so many women who think that incontinence and prolapse are normal, especially as we get older, and it's not.
Thank you. And do you know the name of the apps, just so that we can put them on the show notes?
Yeah, so one I laugh about is the Buff Muff, and the other is Juno Femme. So Juno Femme is the pressure sensor that you can use with an app to be able to determine the coordination of pressure points for coordination of pelvic floor contraction. And if you have a prolapse, where you need to stop in your range of motion, not to make it worse.
Brilliant. Thank you. And we will put those on the notes. And can you talk more about what your work has shown on women and fasting? And more generally, what food and nutrition ethos do you follow? Because when we heard you talk about why women's brains work differently first thing in the morning, it was like a light bulb moment for me personally, because my husband and I, we both intermittent fast, and I've always been so annoyed that I'm always so hungry in the morning, and he can push on with his fast for like another 3 or 4 or even 5 hours. What is going on there? And why is it that men can drop sugar or alcohol and their body changes, but the same often isn't true for us women? And as Mel Robbins said to you, her husband insists that abs are built in the kitchen, but your research has shown the opposite.
Yes. So this is one of the things that blows up on the internet whenever I come on and say women shouldn't fast. So we have to be very aware of the sex difference in appetite control and neuropeptide control. So if I'm on something like Mel Robbins and I have to talk very general, then it doesn't quite make sense. So I'm going to be a little bit technical here, and then I'll be very general afterwards. So bear with me. We have this appetite hormone, ghrelin, and that's our hunger hormone. When we're talking about it being active, it's called acylated ghrelin. And this has a higher circulation rate in women than men, especially first thing in the morning. So what happens is you have this hunger hormone that is upregulated and higher amounts circulating that is activating all the feedback mechanism, specifically in the hypothalamus. So in the hypothalamus, the area of the brain that is kind of like the control center for our appetite hormones and our endocrine hormones, as well as our temperature control. And in that endocrine hormone cadre, we also have cortisol. When ghrelin is upregulated or high circulations throughout the body, it also stimulates this neuropeptide called neuropeptide Y. And this is one that's like, okay, I need some food. And neuropeptide Y also stimulates kisspeptin. Now, kisspeptin is the key peptide in the hypothalamus that is really specific to women versus men, because we have two areas in the brain where kisspeptin is upregulated when we don't have a lot of food. And when it's upregulated, that means that the hypothalamus feels like it's under threat. So it starts to downregulate our metabolism. It starts to have a feedback through the entire body to start kind of conserving. So then if we are going to exercise in this fasted state, instead of being very free with free fatty acids for fuel, it signals really to start breaking down our lean mass to use more amino acids for fuel. We also see that women who hold a fast for a longer period of time, so say you're trying to hold on for another 3 or 4 hours, like your husband, then your ghrelin levels are really elevated and you're trying to avoid that feeling of hunger. So there's a compensatory where your body starts to move less. We see women that hold their fast for a long period of time tend to move less in the day and crave more simple carbohydrates. Because again, this is your hypothalamus saying, I need fuel. I need carbohydrate because that's a quick fuel. I need it for my brain. So when we start looking at fasting and the data that's coming out about fasting, there's a significant sex difference. But yet it's not being shouted out because the influencers who are promoting fasting.
And men, yeah.
Yeah. And then the data that's coming out to support women shouldn't fast kind of gets shut down because it's such a cultural thing when we talk about nutrition that if someone, you go up to someone and you start talking to them, they're like, I'm keto, I'm IF, I'm vegan, I'm plant-based. It's a cultural identity. So now if we're challenging with scientific data to say that you should not be fasting, it's like a dagger to their ethos. So trying to unpack it and explain, look, for women, our hypothalamus is more sensitive to appetite control and low nutrient density. So you do need to eat within a half an hour or so of waking up so that your body doesn't feel like it's under a lot of stress and can say, I have fuel to get on with all the things that are happening in the day. And one of the critical things is we have cortisol. It's an important hormone for us because we have little stress points during the day, and cortisol comes up and down in response to the stress points. But if we don't eat first thing in the morning, we have an undue amount of cortisol that's released with every one of those stress points, which means that our response to something like traffic going slow is above and beyond what it should be from a physiological standpoint. So we're perpetuating inflammation and stress responses. And we can really tap that on the head by just having some food in the morning.
That's so interesting because it goes against what so many of us have done for so long. And that's one thing I still do. I don't have breakfast until about 10 o'clock. I exercise early. So again, something I need to think through.
So sorry, Stacey, are you saying that women shouldn't fast at all, like even intermittent fast? Sorry to dive in.
So when we're looking at the fasting data, if you exercise, you shouldn't fast. And I say that because exercise in itself is a fasting state. When we look at intermittent fasting versus time-restricted eating, two different things. Time-restricted eating is what I think everyone in the entire world should do in our first world populations because you're working with your circadian rhythm, especially for women. So if you wake up with your cortisol awakening response, which is normal, so it peaks about a half an hour after you wake up, and you have food, and then you eat throughout the day, making sure you get protein and fiber at almost every eating opportunity. And then you finish dinner, you don't have anything else, so you have about 2 or so hours before bed, you end up with a 12 or 13 hour overnight fast. Not only that, if you are not eating that close to bedtime, then your body has the ability to get into deep sleep and really good sleep architecture. We see that circadian rhythm disruption happens really easily when we move our food intake because food and light and darkness are the two most powerful things to cause circadian rhythm disruption. So if we are waking up and we're not eating until 10 or 11 and we've been up since 7 or 6:30 or earlier, we are phase shifting. And when we're phase shifting, that means that we are disrupting our melatonin peak at night, which means that we can't get to sleep as early as we should. Our body doesn't have the ability to get into really good parasympathetic activation, so we miss out on a lot of that really good deep sleep that's reparative. So if we're looking at how do we optimize our health span, time-restricted eating is fine. But what I mean by that is normal eating, where you're eating throughout the day to fuel for the task at hand. You stop eating when you finish dinner so that you're not going to bed on a full stomach and your body can do all the reparation it needs to at night. when we talk about fasting and telomere length changes, and we're talking about the cell senescence and our resilience of DNA, all of that comes with exercise. So if you're exercising, you are garnering the benefits of all the data that you hear about with fasting. And if you're doing time-restricted eating, which is that overnight fast, you're definitely setting your body up really well for a really good health span in later life.
So if women want to and need to lose weight, what would your advice be in terms of how they eat? Because for a lot of us, we simply eat less. And also, what would you say to women who aren't hungry first thing in the morning, because that's definitely me, and tend to just have a cup of coffee, maybe with some collagen powder in it? And within all of this, can you explain to women how starving yourself makes you lose muscle and why women might actually need to eat more if they need to lose excess fat?
Definitely. So this leads on from our, you know, fuel during the day. There are a lot of us that are not hungry first thing in the morning. Part of it is we've had a learned response with that. And the other is this disconnect where we see cortisol rising, and this can have an effect on our appetite hormones, where we have a dysregulation of our appetite hormones. And if we are not eating first thing in the morning because we don't feel hungry, it's like a catch-22 where our cortisol keeps coming up. And then we have an oscillation of cortisol that's higher than it should, which then further perturbs our appetite hormones. So we have to relearn how to be hungry in the morning. So we can train our gut and our brain to be hungry when we wake up. But again, it's that our shift in our circadian rhythm. We need to bring the calories closer to when we wake up. Because if we have that overnight fast, you will be hungry when you wake up. It's just we've gotten into a sociocultural habit of eating later. And as women, I'm not hungry first thing in the morning. I'm going to skip those calories and push it off to later in the day. And then you might bookend your calories towards the end of the day. Then you go to bed too full and you wake up and you're not hungry, and it becomes this catch-22. So if we're trying to lose weight, there are a few things that we can do. First and foremost is our protein intake. You really need to think about the recommended daily allowance that's out there is based on a minimum amount that you need to consume to prevent malnutrition. So if we're thinking about the general active woman who is concerned about her health span and wants to age appropriately, the RDA is way too low for her. We also see that protein and exercise, we become less responsive to it as we get older. So the protein intake is really important. One, that helps us with our neurotransmitters and our appetite and appetite hormones and our endocrine system, but also because protein is responsible for metabolically active tissue, it goes to preserve our bone and our lean mass when we're looking for a slight calorie deficit. The way that I counsel women is we want to eat throughout the day, and then we can take a slight calorie deficit of 150 to 200 calories away from the evening meal. Because one, then you aren't going to bed with a lot in your stomach. You've had a decent meal. You've had 40 grams of protein and fiber, but now we're skipping the extra snack. We might not have that little bit of extra rice, or maybe we're not having a glass or two of wine. It's really easy to take away those little extra bits of calories. And then you're sleeping better. If we're sleeping better, then we have better metabolic control. The one thing that women and men tend to forget is that if you have disrupted sleep, you will not have any kind of change. Because if you have disrupted sleep, your body always feels like it's in a fatigued state. So it's going to have greater inflammation, and you're going to keep craving simple carbohydrates. And this feeds forward to, again, trying to delay food intake, and it keeps in that catch-22. So ideally, we are strength training 2 to 3 times a week. We have a little bit of high-intensity work in there. We are eating according to our circadian rhythm, so we're having food throughout the day, and we are sleeping really well at night, and we have a higher emphasis on protein and fiber. That in itself is like the baseline. And when women start nailing that, they see inflammation goes down, sleep is better, body composition changes without really trying to put too much extra effort in.
And can we also talk more generally about women and cortisol and how this impacts our sleep, which you've kind of touched on, thank you, but also very much your thoughts on women and cold plunging versus women and sauna. And Sophie, I'm thinking about you here because I know that you do cold plunge every morning.
Yeah, sure. So if we're thinking about cortisol, it's gotten such a demonized name across all media platforms. But cortisol is an essential hormone. It's how we respond to stress and how we become super alert. It's also really important when we exercise to allow our body's heart rate to come up, our breathing rate to come up, allow us to access more fuel for our contractile muscles. The reason cortisol has gotten such a demonization in a lot of the popular media and outside medical clinics and such is because it is that stress hormone, and we're perpetually in that sympathetic drive, that flight or fight. So if we're looking at ways to bring our baseline cortisol down, I like to explain it like your resting heart rate. As you add exercise into your daily routine or every other day routine, and you start getting fitter, your resting heart rate comes down, and that's your new baseline. So if we're looking at how do we mitigate a cortisol peak by having food first thing in the morning, how do we allow our body to have more parasympathetic activation by having really good sleep and doing some mindfulness practice? Maybe we are using environmental factors to help get that parasympathetic response. Over the course of a few weeks, our baseline cortisol comes down. So now we feel that we are no longer in that tired but wired flight or fight sensation all of the time. When we talk about using environmental stress like cold plunge or sauna, there is a nuance within cold plunging where we don't have to be in ice water to garner benefits. We see from the research that women do better in 10 to 14 degrees Celsius water, not ice. Ice water is too cold and invokes a really strong constriction response that is increasing the sympathetic drive, not what we want. If we look at that 10 to 14, 16 degree water, it's cold enough to drive some of our stress responses up, but it is not overly cold where we can't have a compensatory parasympathetic response. And that's what we're after. We also see that women don't get as much of a robust response to cold as men do, but they have a better response to the heat. And the reason for that are the specific sex differences in thermoregulation, where when women go into a really hot environment, we vasodilate first. So we're trying to offload heat, not through sweating, but through our blood vessels opening up and bringing more of the heat to the skin. And so we have all of our blood flow going to the palms of our hands and our feet. And then maybe we start sweating when our core temperature comes up, and that could be 10 to 15, 20 minutes into a sauna. But a man comes in and he starts sweating almost immediately, and his core temperature goes up really quickly. And we see that a man might last 10 to 15 minutes in the sauna, where a woman can last much longer. Part of it is the fact that we have these sex differences in thermoregulation. But the other is, over the course of our reproductive life, our core temperature oscillates about 1 degree Celsius every month, depending on how estrogen and progesterone come into play. So we already have the ability to change our thermoregulatory thresholds with heat exposure because our body is used to that. So when we're talking about environmental stressors to increase parasympathetic response, it is an individual choice. I know if Sophie, you love cold plunge, maybe you try a cool water plunge and see if that does a little bit more because you can stay in a little bit longer. But for me, I get such severe rain odds that the idea of getting into a cold plunge means that I'm going to have burning hands and feet for about 24 hours. So I much rather get in the sauna and garner the benefits that way.
That makes complete sense. I actually haven't cold plunged since I moved house. My cold plunge is still sitting there, empty, needing some attention. It's just not been high on the priority list. My sauna blanket, however, is upstairs.
Nice.
how can women get more protein? And what are your thoughts on protein shakes? For example, what do you think about plant-based protein shakes and vegans or vegetarians trying to get more protein? Do you have any tips?
Yes, I'm always food first. And people have this idea that it's really, really difficult to get protein in. I had a woman ask me today, in fact, how do I get 150 grams of protein in if I'm trying to watch my cholesterol as well? So I'm not talking about big slabs of meat. I'm also not talking about go all in with our protein supplementation. It could be if you eat eggs and dairy, you're doing scrambled eggs with some feta cheese on sprouted grain toast for breakfast, and you're getting 30-ish grams of protein right there. Or maybe you're doing low-fat Greek yogurt and chia with nuts and berries. Then again, there's another 30 grams of protein right there. We try to get protein and fiber at every eating opportunity, like I said earlier. One, because if we get in the habit of looking at all the different types of protein that's out there, from edamame and green peas and tempeh and tofu to our traditional eggs and lean meat and poultry and fish, then we have a wide variety of different types of proteins that we can have throughout the day, and it becomes much easier. I don't think that it's really that feasible for someone to go from a typical intake of around 80 grams of protein to doubling that overnight. So just like strength training, we phase it in. We look and go, okay, well, instead of white rice, I'll have quinoa and amaranth because that has higher protein. So just little swaps here and there to increase our total protein intake. If we're thinking about supplementation for protein shakes, vegan protein shakes, if you're doing a pea protein isolate, it's just right on the cusp of having the same amount of leucine and amino acid profile as whey protein isolate. You just have to have 30-gram serving instead of a 25-gram serving. But again, if we can get more out of real food, we're not as smart as nature. Nature has all sorts of cofactors within the food that makes things work for us, our micronutrients and our macronutrients. If we rely solely on our protein supplementation that's really easy to grab, we miss out on so much of the fiber and micronutrient components of real food that a lot of people end up with some malnutrition and lack of our essential micronutrients. So again, it's real food first, and then supplementation is there to supplement. I admit I have some protein powder every day just because of lifestyle and the fact that I'm not hungry first thing in the morning. So if I put protein into my coffee with some almond milk, there's a good 30-gram hit of protein and I'm ready to go. So there's lots of things that we can think about with protein. It's just not trying to get it all in all at once, and we want to phase in. And our body isn't an algorithm. So there will be days where you have more and other days that you have less, but don't beat yourself up about it. It's the overall trend that we're looking for, not our acute day-to-day hitting these specific numbers. Because food's supposed to be fun. So if you don't have the fun in all of that and you're just so focused on the macronutrient numbers, then we're missing the nuance of what it means to be human and the ability to choose.
Thank you so much, Stacey. And just on a more personal level, what's your daily routine, both in terms of food and meals as well as exercise? How much exercise do you do and what does it look like?
I travel a lot. So I tend to, my daughter laughs. She's like, Mom, when you travel, the very first thing you do is you look for a gym and wherever you're going to stay. I'm like, yep. A hotel has to have a good gym, or there has to be a good gym nearby, because that's my one non-negotiable. I come from an endurance background, like I said, but I take strength training with me wherever I go because it is a way of maintaining some coordination of, you know, consistency. But if I'm at home, then I tend to get up before everyone else so I can have 20-ish minutes of no noise and just kind of ease into the day while I have my coffee. And then depending on the day, I'll go to the gym and do a heavy strength class 3 times a week and a high intensity, what we call a metabolic capacity session, once a week. And then I'll pepper it in with, if I'm training for a gravel race, then I'll take out the capacity and I'll put in some more riding. Or if summer's coming and I want to do more ocean swimming, then I'll try to lean into more swimming. So it depends on season, because I'm not racing per se. I'm not training for anything but life right now.
The only thing I can say is that strength training is the mainstay wherever I am, either at home or traveling. And I am plant-based for the most part, meaning that I was vegan for a very long time, but now I do some dairy. I do some Greek yogurt and some whey protein powder, especially because of traveling. It's hard going to different places and being very specific at what you eat. So I know that those are two things I can find everywhere, or I can bring with me, especially protein powder. So if I think about food and meals, I have some before I train, and then I have my real breakfast when I get home from whatever training I'm doing. And that's usually a bowl of overnight oats and chia seeds with some berries and some nuts and some yogurt and, of course, more coffee. And then lunch is a variety of fruit and veg and toast. I love toast. And some sprouted grains to go with it. When my daughter gets home, we have afternoon tea, and then that's a protein-oriented snack of some sort. So today was banana chocolate chip protein muffins with some mango on the side. And then dinner, the base of all of our dinner is a big plate of colorful fruit and veg. And then my husband will put on some fish or some chicken, and I'll have tempeh or tofu. And then my daughter will have a bit of both.
This sounds very similar to what your routine is as well, Sophie. We'd also love to know if you take creatine, and if so, do you cycle it? And what other supplements do you take, if any? And one more thing, testosterone, do you take it? What are your thoughts on that? Basically, what's your stack in terms of supplements, particularly with creatine?
I am a diehard creatine user, yes. It is a little bit of a holdover from when I was racing, just because as a vegan, when you're racing high intensity and high level, it's really hard to get a lot of the muscle power and recovery without creatine, because it is an animal-based thing unless it's created in the lab. So I do between 5 and 10 grams of creatine a day. On times where I have heavy fatigue blocks where I'm traveling or lots of brain work, then I'll do closer to the 10 grams. But on a general day, it's closer to the 5 grams. I do omega-3s on a consistent basis, and I do vitamin D3 on a consistent basis, especially down here in New Zealand in the middle of winter when the light is very low and the days are very dull. Testosterone for women, I think, is an up-and-coming thing. We see that testosterone doesn't decrease precipitously like estrogen and progesterone with perimenopause, but it does take a hit because your body's under a lot of stress. I have used testosterone in the past. That's because after I had my daughter, I was amenorrheic for almost 4 years, and it came down to very low testosterone levels. So I was on transdermal testosterone for a bit, and it boosted me back up, but now I don't use any hormones. So if I were to say, what is my stack? On general, it is the creatine, the omega-3s, the vitamin D, and then I'll throw in some rhodiola and shishandra days here and there, but those are pretty much my go-tos.
Thank you so much for sharing. That's super helpful. And I guess lastly, is there anything we've not covered that you'd like my listeners to hear?
One of the things that I've learned over the past few years as I've started to get larger profile in general community coming from a high performance background is that we tend to forget that there's a bell curve. And when I'm talking about all of this stuff, it's in the middle of the bell curve. And of course, there are outliers. So if you're an early adopter and you're like, I know all this stuff, great, keep doing it, spread the word, bring some other people on board. If you're in the middle of the bell curve and some of this is new, just do some biohacking and find out what works for you. Because again, the robustness of science for women isn't as what we would like it to be. And if you're a late adopter and this is all brand new to you, know that it's a journey. And again, you need to find out what works for you. There isn't a prescriptive rule. There isn't a prescriptive schedule you have to follow. We're all trying to navigate this together. And the more that we talk about it and the more we empower each other, the more that we can find out what works specifically for us as women as we get older.
Thank you so much, Stacey. And for all of you listening, you can find out more about Dr. Stacey, including her terrific courses and training, at allthews.d Dr. Stacy, and that's just S-T-A-C-Y, Sims, S-I-M-S, .com. And do follow her on socials at Dr. Stacy Sims. Thank you so much for sharing so much of your knowledge, Stacy.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
And that ends this week's podcast. If you want to find out more about me and my work, or maybe book a consultation, head to drsophieschotter.com, and you can find me on socials at drsophieschotter. And again, thank you so much for listening.